I was muted there. Okay, we are here. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our weekly call. We spent a few minutes talking about some persuasion tools. Take your questions via email or via Skype or via the phone and teach you to become power persuaders. So this is Kurt Mortensen as we get into the tools that you need to help you out. Of course, recordings will be posted on whypersuasion.com. We also have some great podcasts that are going. You can find those at MaximizeYourInfluence.com that will help you out as we get into some more tools. Let's just talk about it. Let's jump into it. And as your questions come in, I will answer those. So one of the themes, I try to pick up different themes in the questions and emails and things that are coming up, even during seminars, is negotiation, and how does that differ from persuasion versus are the tools the same, or what are the blunders? You know, I'm big on the blunders and those sort of things. Oh, well, first of all, I was reading an article, and see if I can pull it up here. It looks like it left my computer screen. That was done at MIT, and it's interesting. We talk about negotiation settings. They talked about psychological arousal and if that helped or hurt negotiations. So let's do some definitions. I'm going to go into that and then take your questions. First of all is, the way I look at it is that you have influence. If you look at a hierarchy, you have influence, you have persuasion, and you have negotiation. I'll always say every time you persuade first, negotiate second. This is why. See, influence is who you are, your trust, your charisma, your past history, your a passion, maybe. They know who you are. You don't need any tools or techniques. They do it because of you. Versus persuasion are the tools and techniques versus negotiation is below that. And people are like, what do you mean? Well, persuasion, you bring someone to your point of view. Negotiations, give, take, and you meet probably somewhere in the middle. Usually with persuasion, a lot of times you are going to have a persuader and a prospect. With negotiation, lots of times you're going to have two different persuaders. So that changes how things are done. I know there's certain things you need to understand as we get into it. Now, let's get to that psychological arousal. What does that mean? Is that some people say, hey, just relax. But they're finding, they wanted to research when you are aroused or nervous or tense or excited, kind of like if you were going to go take a test, how do you feel before that test? Does that help or hurt the negotiation? And here's the answer. It depends. It turns out that whether you're someone who dreads or looks forward to negotiation, that's what it came down to. If you like, oh, no, then it had the negative effect. But if you were excited and going through that, then it had a positive effect. You know, I teach this in public speaking. It's okay to have butterflies as long as you get those butterflies to fly in formation, that nervous, that energy. You see a professional quarterback will have that. If I'm speaking to a group of 1,000 people, I'll have that too. But the way we get past that is that you know you're prepared. You've done your research. You've done it before. You know you can do it. You know you can handle it. Even though you have that nervous energy of wanting to do a good job, all those people out there, or the negotiation, you can do that. When you're prepared, the fear diminishes. And that's what's important with negotiations especially. You're going to pay with your time up front, with your pre-negotiation checklist, doing the research, or you're going to pay with lost money on the back end. I mean, that's the only way to really look at it. That's a huge piece of what they found. And that nervous energy, like I mentioned before, they found out that it's also part of whether you are public speaking, competitive sports, test performance. It all comes in there to take that nervous energy. See, people who can't stand negotiating seem to interpret arousal as a negative sign of nervousness, and therefore it has the opposite effects on their performance. But those who relish the chance to negotiate seem to interpret arousal as a positive sign of excitement, making them feel revved up, and the arousal boosts their performance. Kind of the difference there. Very important to understand with negotiation, because that energy is okay. And when you get into that negotiation, there's a lot of things that are being taught that aren't right. The main one is never make the first offer. Now, if you haven't done any research, you have no idea what it's worth, you're shooting in the dark, probably don't want to go first. But what happens is when you go first, it does two things. It shows the other side that you're willing to go first. It shows the other side that you're opening up. It shows the other side that you will come to negotiate. Because if both sides have been to the same negotiation school and never make the first offer, it's going to be a long negotiation. There's going to be people are going to be tense. They're going to be nervous. There's going to be lack of trust. And it's going to be a long negotiation. Versus, I'll open it up. That's the first reason. The second reason is the person, the studies show, numerous studies show that the person that goes first gets to dictate the starting point of the negotiation, whether it's really high or really low, which does affect your terms that you're going to get. So you need to take a look at both of those and realize, okay, which one do I want to do? And understand that part of that, the big word, it's called reciprocal concessions, meaning that if you go into negotiation, you're like, they're wrong, they won't persuade me, they're wrong, I'm going to win, you're going to get the same thing mirrored back to you. Now, what reciprocal concessions are is that if you let them persuade you on a few points, if you give them a few concessions, they're more inclined to do the same thing. They'll give you some concessions. So let them persuade you on a few points, whether it's a negotiation or even a teenager. Let them persuade you on a few points, and down the road they'll be more open for you to persuade them on a few points, for you to ask for a few concessions. It's human nature. It's very important to understand. Because you want to keep the negotiation going from beginning to end. You never start with the most complex item, the most tense item, which could be the money. Start with the easiest stuff first. Okay, deadlines, December 31st. Okay, interest rate, 3%. Okay, color, quantity. We get into there slowly and do that. Then you get to your yes, you get the ball rolling, and there's just one final point to work out, which probably could be the price, then it's easier to do that. That's why in negotiation we call the set-aside technique, to where if you hit a brick wall, you say, hey, well, let's, before we continue, let's just set that aside for now. Let's get everything else out of the way first. Get the momentum. In fact, never, if you can help it during a negotiation, try not to get the no. No, that's dumb, I'm not going to do it. So, no, let's set that aside. Because if you get no, a lot of times it'll slam the door, and when you try to turn that no into yes, it's difficult. But if you turn a maybe, or we'll talk about it later, let's look at a few more things, that's easier to turn to a yes than someone who's already said no. And that's important as you look in the negotiation process and how that works. And always before negotiations, write up all your concessions that you're willing to give. I don't care if you want them or you don't want them. For example, selling a home. I'll give you the whole home with the play set, the cabinets in the garage, and the grand piano. It's all yours. No. You keep those aside. So they say, I wanted to do 4% instead of 5%. Well, then, I can't have the grand piano in there. So you can negotiate. Keep things to negotiate. Keep that. Because if you look at the law of contrast, if you want to listen to that magnetic persuasion, is the worst thing that you can do with when you're creating value during a negotiation is you get all this. Here's the 27 things you get for your money. No, here are the two things you get for money, but I'm going to give you this and this and this and this, an extra $10,000 worth of things. It increases the value. That famous bake sale study you've heard me talk about, to where the first day was, hey, cupcake and two cookies together, 75 cents, great deal, 40% bought. Next day, hey, cupcake, 75% as a bonus, get two cookies, 70% bought. You see the difference there? And that's important that you understand that, building that and understanding how important it is to be ready before you get there. Most people, and MIT found this through research, even the multilateral five-country negotiations, people just show up, see what's going to happen, see what's going on, see what the other side's going to offer, versus really studying, really doing the research, really putting yourself in their shoes, really coming up with multiple options, realizing they might come up with a better option than you, to keep that communication going. That is what's so important when you get into a negotiation process. So, understand, in persuasion negotiation, I learned this from Earl Nightingale, and we'll take some questions here, is that you can't send a 6 to persuade a 9. You can't send a 6 to negotiate with a 9, meaning if you're influencing up, if you're influencing a CEO, you have to realize that they got there because their ability to communicate, their ability to influence. And if you're only a 5 or 6, you have to negotiate and persuade with a 9. You need to become a 9. You need to become a 10. You need to get more tools, whether it's negotiation, whether it's asking for a pay raise. That is very important. So think about those things today. As you go into the negotiation, you negotiate every day, whether it's where to eat, you negotiate with your teenagers, you negotiate at work. It's always part of the process. try that tool this week, especially the set-aside technique and the understanding reciprocal concessions, and you'll see a big difference in what you do. So at any time as we go through this, the recording we post at whypersuasion.com, but I'll answer some questions that are coming in. You can, those are also through whypersuasion.com. Those are on Skype. You can post them there. Those are live on the phone. Or those doing replay, which most of you do, you can just send those to me or type in over the phone. So let's talk about it. I'll just read the question here. It's just talking about the law of expectations or negotiations. Well, yeah, what you expect tends to happen. You don't have I mentioned earlier, a professional quarterback doesn't say, oh, what if I throw an interception? What if I do this? What if I don't do that? The mindset's a big part of this. Like one of the study shows, and I just put this in the second edition of Maximum Influence, is that when you feel influential, you go into a situation negotiation, whether you are or not, it's irrelevant. If you're feeling influential, you become more influential. Isn't that interesting? That's expectations. We have to monitor those expectations. During the expectations that the negotiation is going to work, the expectations that they're going to open up. It's a powerful thing. You know, you can do a mean trick on a coworker, get three or four people together and say, you sick? They're like, no, I'm not sick. And they're like, are you sick? No, I don't think so. Hey, you're a bit pale. You okay? I'm like, oh, no. By the fourth, fifth time, they go home feeling sick. I mean, that's just how powerful the brain is. I mean, we talk about placebos. They work, depending on the study, 30 to 50% of the time. So expectations that you're going to solve the issue, expectations that they're going to open up, does go a long way. It's a great question. That's in one of the 12 lots of persuasion that we talked about. Good question. The question here, as far as who did the study? Okay, it was Brown and Curhan, if you want to know that. They're also from MIT. It was published yesterday, and it's something that will go a long way with what you're talking about, that nervous energy. Because a lot of times people just take it the wrong route. We talked about that professional football player. They channel that. My daughter she loved to speak. She loved being in front of an audience until people started playing with me. Are you nervous? I'd be nervous. Are you nervous? And all of a sudden, that's her expectations, because that's what expected her to feel. And they planted that seed. Oh, a question about how you overcome fear. Well, that's a whole other seminar, but basically realize that, first of all, the thing is to realize you're only born with two fears. Every human's born with the fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. So the fears you have, fear of success, fear of criticism, fear of failure, all learned fears, fear of public speaking, learned fears. So try to figure out where you've learned it. And the big things is that and everything's a little different. So when I teach public speaking, we talk about visualization. Thoughts control your emotions, emotions control your actions. So if you can visualize yourself, you're doing a great job, your audience laughing, that goes a long way. If you are prepared, the fear diminishes. I mean, you really know that intro. You really know your information. That tends to diminish the fear. Having some type of a ritual where maybe you want to pace or listen to music or get in the zone. You can do it for those, the Brady Bunch, so you can imagine the audience in your underwear. If that works for you, go for it. So there's different things. Everyone's a little bit different here, and so it's important to just kind of get past that, but realize, too, what's the worst thing that could happen. And I teach public speaking, I let people know, that's probably happened to me. I've tripped on stage. I've been on stage with my fly down. I've taken a drink of water, and I sprayed the front row. I've made mistakes. I've walked onto the wrong stage. You name it, it's happened to me. So it's how you handle that. And the audience is rooting for you. You have to realize that your audience is paying either with their time or their money. They want you to do a good job. They don't want to be bored out of their mind. And that's something to think about. The biggest one is the preparation, the visualization, and to really get in their zone and realize, okay, what's the worst thing could happen? Maybe you might forget something. Okay, whatever. Maybe they might not laugh as much as you want. Okay, next, let's move on. Let's get past that. Good question. Reading the next question here. Okay. It's about negotiation. And what happens when the other side will not bend at all? Yeah. Give up? Is that the answer that you want? Well, you can, it depends on the situation. You can always find another negotiator. You can say, let's take a break and reconvene tomorrow and kind of go over things that you have solved. You can come up, make the pie bigger with other alternatives. You can give them that. So, okay, well, I'll give you an extra $50,000, but we'll have to go back here and adjust the price per unit and do this and that to where you can work it out. And it depends. If they're being the type of negotiator that's in your face, very aggressive, very old school, doing good cop, bad cop, maybe you don't want to do business with them. Maybe you, and that's a whole other thing if you've been listening to negotiation, the dirty deeds. But maybe it's time to walk. You know, if it's something you've got to seal, there are ways to handle those. But you've got to help that. And then some people, you've got to give them something to argue about. That's what they want. They've come to argue. They come to negotiate. Because one of the first worst things you can do during negotiation is accept too quickly. What does that mean? Well, let's talk about it. I was talking to a real estate person. They went into a home, and they did their math. They were just getting started. And they came up to the person, and they said, how much do you want for your house? And they said, well, let's make some numbers up, $152,000. He said, okay, I'll take it. Win-win for everyone, and walked away. And they came back a couple of days with the paperwork, and they had a phone call that the buyer was going to back out. Now, when someone comes into a negotiation, they're expecting to negotiate. Whether you want to or not, it's irrelevant. You've got to play the game. You've got to persuade people how they want to be persuaded. They've come to negotiate. If you accept too quickly, even if it's a win-win offer, they're going to have buyer's remorse. They're always going to think, I could have done better. Why did they accept so quickly? Is there something I don't know? Can I get a better price? That was too easy. What's going on? You have to be careful that you know that they're expecting to negotiate. That's very important. Okay, any other questions? One more here. Oh, when to accept the offer? I can't put an exact number in there, but you want to banter back and forth a little bit and say, and you can always say, well, is that the best offer? Is that the best you can do? See where they're at? And go back and forth a few times, and that's probably, you're going to know, you're going to sense it, you're going to see it in their face, when their face relaxes, when they're getting the terms that they want. That'll be very helpful to you. Great questions. All right, so go out there, persuade with power. Again, we're posting everything at whypersuasion.com. Just want to spend a few minutes on a tool, take your questions. We do this every week. You can listen to the recording. We have our podcast at maximizeyourinfluence.com. But go out there, persuade with power, and we'll see you next week. See everyone.